And beside this road, and the landowner came and asked me could I pick cotton that week, that they would carry me to a commissary store. It was little stores they would have on the plantations, you know.
Clinton announced his executive order on race relations in the United States to take effect for the remainder of his term in office. The initiative was intended to prompt a national dialogue on, among other things, the recent history of race relations and the course we are charting at present on issues of race. In this program, Bruderhof Radio joins the discussion with a look at one specific historical incident that permanently changed attitudes to race in this country and played a defining role in what became the civil rights movement of the 1960s. On June 21, 1964, three young civil rights workers were returning home to Meridian, Mississippi, from a day's visit to nearby Longdale, when their car was pulled over by police, not an uncommon occurrence for activists at that time. But this time, the arrest was anything but routine. Days after the three men disappeared, the smoldering shell of their station wagon was found on the side of the road. Few people doubted that James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman were dead. Meanwhile, emerging evidence seemed to point in one direction, the local members of the Ku Klux Klan. Ben Chaney is the younger brother of James Chaney, and vividly remembers the days of uncertainty following his brother's disappearance.
The bodies were found on August 4th. The murders took place on June 21st. Now, that's like 44 days. Mm-hmm. It was a Sunday morning when they left our house in Meridian to go to Neshoba County to investigate the burning of the church. My brother and Mickey said they was going to come back, and, you know, I expected my brother to come back. I think everyone else believed that they were dead once they did not return that Sunday evening. I'm convinced that everyone else believed they were dead, but I didn't think that my brother would be murdered. It wasn't until the funeral on August 6th that I realized that my brother was actually dead. It became real to me.
Andy was an activist from the time he was 15 years of age.
Carolyn Goodman, the mother of Andrew Goodman, reflects on the anniversary of her son's death.
He and a friend traveled to Kentucky to see for themselves the conditions that miners lived under. The shacks, the poor plumbing, the low wages for doing dangerous jobs. The owners were making large sums of money. The miners barely survived. This experience, along with his schooling, where such issues were discussed, and his family environment, had an impact on Andy that shaped his life. We raised our three sons to think for themselves, and they all chose different paths in life. We supported our children in their choices, even though, as with Andy, it was so difficult to see him go to Mississippi, where the Klan and white citizens councils were using attack dogs and strong water hoses to break up the activities of young people striving to exercise their civil rights and to improve the quality of life in their hometown. But Andy left our home knowing that his parents were with him all the way.
Both Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner had come to Mississippi in 1964 as student organizers from New York. Like hundreds of other students at that time, they came through programs like the National Council of Churches Mississippi Summer Project and the Congress of Racial Equality, also known as CORE. James Chaney, on the other hand, was a native of Meridian, Mississippi, and had joined the movement in search of his own rights as an African American. We spoke to Ben Chaney about his brother's early involvement in the civil rights movement and how he met Michael Schwerner and his wife Rita in 1964.
He was suspended from high school in 1961 in Meridian, Mississippi for making paper NAACP badges and for doing some youth organizing on the high school campus. He went back to school after the principal agreed to let him back in, him and two of his friends back in. And then in 1963, he got involved in the Freedom Rides. And he pretty much in mid-63, late-63, was like on a peripheral role. He played a peripheral role in the movement. In 1964, early 64, January 64, he met Matt Suarez, who was a worker for CORE from New Orleans that was in Mississippi, that came over to Meridian, Mississippi, where we live. Mm-hmm. And he began to do some basic organizing with Matt Suarez. And then when Mickey and Rita Swarner came into town, he became their liaison in the community and in the surrounding counties. My brother would take these trips out of town, and he would come in two or three days later, and sometimes he would come in very late at night, and he would talk to my mother. And, you know, he would describe what was going on, him and some of his friends who was working with him in COFO at the time. And in the daytime, they used to, in certain counties in Mississippi, they used to have to sleep, they used to have to crawl under people's houses, or hide in people's houses until night, because they couldn't come out in the daytime to do no organizing. I know for a fact that several times in the Shelby County, my brother was in the county late at night. He used to drive high speeds on dirt roads without any headlights, and he would be chased by Cecil Price, who was the deputy sheriff. I also know that that had my brother been caught along without Andrew Goodman and Michael Swarner, my brother would have ended up, like so many other African-American males who ended up disappearing, and their bodies only to be found floating in a Mississippi river or lake. During the period where they were searching for my brother and his companions, they found more than 9 bodies of African-American males who were college students, but who was also working in the movement, and who ended up being missing, who disappeared. And the authorities, and once their disappearance was reported, the authorities wouldn't even search for their bodies. And they found these bodies while they was looking for my brother's body. Some of them were decapitated. Some had their torsos totally separated, cut in half. So I'm convinced that had he been caught by himself, he would have been murdered, and no one would have had any second thoughts about it. It's unfortunate that in this country, particularly during that period in the South, it took the deaths of whites before people realized that hundreds of other people, that many, many other people were out there in the struggle and were dying on a regular basis, and no one paid any attention to it. My brother was targeted by the Sovereignty Commission along with Mickey Swarner, and he became... a lot of attention was given to him and his role because he was such a close, him and Mickey Swan were very close, and they would often be seen together. And as a result, my brother was talking, but the reality of it, we got to keep in mind that the Klan had planned to murder Mickey Swan back in April of 1964. And as a result, they had agreed, they had laid their plot down. And they knew that Mickey Swarner did not drive up to Neshoba County by himself. Each time he went, my brother was there. In fact, my brother drove the car because Mickey just didn't know the area and he didn't know the people. So it would have been impossible to kill Mickey without killing my brother.
According to Ben, fear was something blacks in Mississippi learned to live with. We asked if James was ever scared.
I don't know if he was fearful. I've been 21 at one time in my life, and there was very few things that I was afraid of. When you're 21, you don't quite understand fear. But I do know that, and my mother still does, she was in the 60s, she would always tell us stories about other people in her family who had been disappeared or who was lynched by the Klan, and people who she knew when she was growing up that was lynched. Mm-hmm. And these were stories that she would constantly tell. And, you know, my mother would tell these stories, and she still does, so that we could remember how endangered the lives of an African American male, particularly a young African American male, was at that time. How easy it is for an African American male to be castrated, to be lynched, to end up missing, and no one try to do anything about it. No, there's no search made. There's no investigation that's taking place. So I know that he knew the stories because I knew the stories by the time I was 11. I knew the stories myself. So I know that he also knew the stories. But I don't think that if there was any fear, I don't think it was the type of fear that would make you that would make him stagnated or petrified. I think it was the type of fear that brought about an urgency to do what he had to do and to achieve whatever goal, whatever small goal he could achieve.
But for all James Chaney and Andrew Goodman did for the civil rights movement, the Ku Klux Klan of Neshoba and Lauderdale counties had another target in mind. Plan 4, as the imperial wizard of the state of Mississippi called it, detailed the elimination of Michael Schwerner, who was hated by the Klan both for his aggressive organizing of African Americans and because he was a Jew.
We were always brought up with a very humanitarian view of the world.
Michael Schwerner's brother, Steve.
A very anti-racist view of the world, a very egalitarian view of the world. I remember as a little kid being brought not only to Yankee Stadium to see New York, we lived in the Bronx, so not only to see Yankee games, but also we were brought up to go to the Negro Baseball League. When Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, we automatically became Dodger fans. I think that generally our upbringing was one of what would be called a pro-humanitarian, pro-labor kind of view of the world. Mickey originally went to Michigan State, wanted to be a veterinarian, transferred to the agricultural school at Cornell, from which he graduated, joined a fraternity mainly in order to integrate it,
mm-hmm.
Which he did. When he graduated from Cornell, he came to New York. He and Rita were in New York. He went to Columbia School of Social Work for a little while, but was working in settlement houses, working as a social worker. And we all belonged to a core chapter in New York and started the civil rights movement. Although it's hard to say when it dated, but I think our involvement started once the sit-in started in February of 60, and then I think Mickey and Rita both felt that that's really what they wanted to do, was to go to Mississippi, and SNCC at the time, and to the same extent CORE, both believed that if you could break segregation in Mississippi, then you could break segregation every place in America. And Mississippi was clearly the most difficult state in the Union. And Mickey and Rita felt that they should be part of it. So they went as a couple working for CORE in January of 1964 to Meridian and organized the Freedom House. I think that anybody who went to Mississippi knew there was real danger, and that anybody who was interested in working in the civil rights movement in the South knew for sure there was danger. Danger was a lot less in the North, although Mickey had gone to some demonstrations in Maryland and in New York City that could have gotten dangerous and had been arrested a couple of times. I think that if you couldn't do that, then you didn't stay in the South. You certainly didn't stay in Mississippi. I mean, you took all kinds of precautions. People were very, very cautious about what they did, and safety was not something that anybody laughed at, but took tremendous precautions to be as safe as possible.
Indeed, it wasn't for any lack of precaution that Schwerner, Chaney, and Goodman found themselves in the Neshoba County Jail during the late afternoon of June 21st. James Chaney, who was driving, had chosen a roundabout route home from Longdale to Meridian in hopes of avoiding a rumored police ambush. But it seems that time was running out for Michael Schwerner. As they neared the town of Philadelphia, the Neshoba County seat, Deputy Sheriff Cecil Price stopped them and arrested them. After spending 7 hours in the county jail, the three were released and drove toward Meridian. But they were being sent into a trap. Members of the local police force and the local Klan followed the civil rights workers, and after a high-speed chase, they were re-apprehended on the back roads outside Philadelphia. From there, they were taken in another police car to an unknown spot where they were, in all probability, brutally beaten and then shot at point-blank range. Their bodies were hidden under tons of dirt at a nearby dam site. After numerous pleas by Michael's wife, Rita, and CORE staff members in Meridian, the FBI opened an investigation. As the search for the bodies of the civil rights workers widened, the bodies of many other African-American males were discovered in the gullies and swamps of Mississippi. Ben Chaney remembers.
I think that a couple of things developed, and not only the events of the deaths of my brother and his companions, but also what happened over the summer while they were looking for those three bodies. I think, first of all, people realized during that period that many African-American males, young males, had already made that ultimate commitment, that ultimate sacrifice for the movement, and had gave up their lives, and no one cared about those particular lives. Mm-hmm. I think that, in fact, I remember hearing Victoria Gray, who was one of the elderly organizers of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, making a statement saying that until the life of a black mother's child is just as valuable as the life of a white mother's child, there'll be no equality, there'll be no justice. Mm-hmm. And this was back in 1964. I think that another thing that happened is people realized across the country realized that when it came down to fighting segregation, discrimination, it didn't matter what color you were, it didn't matter who you were, that those forces, those evil demonic forces who wanted to keep people apart, who felt that segregated forces, segregationists, would do anything to protect their way of life and their system. And I think that race then became pretty much insignificant when it came to a life and death situation. I think what happened was it did provide an impetus for the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, just as much of it was the main impetus, perhaps, other than those legal efforts that gave way to the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Slowly, evidence of a wider conspiracy surfaced, and the case was finally broken open when a few Klan members agreed to become informants. On December 4, 1964, federal authorities arrested 19 men for, quote, conspiring to deprive Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman of their civil rights under color of state law. Even so, it wasn't until October of 1967 that convictions were finally passed down in the case of United States versus Cecil Price. 7 men, mostly known Klan members and prominent figures in Neshoba and Lauderdale counties, were sentenced to prison terms ranging from 3 to 10 years. This was the first time that convictions had been obtained in Mississippi in a case involving the killing of civil rights workers. The New York Times called the verdict a measure of the quiet revolution that is taking place in Southern attitudes. But for family members like Steve Schwerner, justice was not and could not be properly served.
I think that we had a significant and, I think, correct skepticism of the role of the federal government. Mm-hmm. The federal government was not willing to protect civil rights workers. They did prosecute some of the people. The state's never done that. So I suppose to that extent, the Justice Department deserves some credit. It's hard to say, because I think the people who did the actual killing who deserve to be punished, and you know, and I think it'd be appropriate for the state of Mississippi to try them still. There's no statute of limitations on murder. But I think the real issues are what allowed the Klan to function the way it did, and that is this kind of a chain, which is that the White Citizens Councils were really the organizations in the state of Mississippi that gave license to the Klan to act in a violent fashion, although the White Citizens Councils were certainly groups that supported that, and that the state legislature in Mississippi and the Sovereignty Commission was supporting the Citizens Council, and the Sovereignty Commission clearly gave out information to the Klan. And I would argue a lot of that was supported by the FBI and the federal government. There's no doubt that the FBI was consistently on the side of local law enforcement. And if you were on the side of local law enforcement, that meant you were opposed to people who were trying to desegregate and bring voting rights into the South. So although the people who did the killing clearly have responsibility for that, I think the responsibility also runs right up the ladder, up into and including the Justice Department and the Kennedy administration. You know, they were missing, quote, the three bodies were missing for 6 weeks, and while they were dragging rivers and looking for the bodies, they found any number of other bodies. Mm-hmm. And they were all blacks, including some activists in the civil rights movement, who had never gotten any national publicity and had never gotten any kind of attention the way Mickey, Andy, and Jim did. And that was clearly a function of the fact that two of the three people who were missing were white and were from the North. And that could mount political pressure through Congress people and through political organizations to get something done. But the people who were missing, who got found, were no less loved by their family and no less concerned about by people who knew them, except that indigenous black folks in Mississippi simply had no way of mounting any pressure and getting anything accomplished in terms of justice. It's unfortunate that lots of other equally horrendous events don't have the same kind of significance. For instance, Mickey, Jim, and Andy are kind of household words, whereas people like Herbert Lee and Lewis Allen and many others who were killed, who were people who lived in Mississippi and struggled with for civil rights for years, are essentially unknown and unrecognized. And again, I mean, I'm not saying that I don't appreciate the recognition, that there's an imbalance, and again, the imbalance is undoubtedly a function of Mickey and Andy being white. If it was Jim Chaney alone who got killed that night, for instance, I suspect there would never have been any national publicity and there would never have been any national search, and that we wouldn't, be holding this conversation, because it wouldn't have been something that got talked about in American textbooks. It's always been significant whenever there's been a progressive movement, not just the South, in the United States, that there is often a group that tries hard to pit blacks against whites, or whites against Latinos, or blacks against Latinos. And the question becomes, whose interest is served by poor people, white and black, fighting with each other? And it's clear the interests that are served are the people who are wealthy and have the most to lose by poor people organizing and working together. And that's happened over and over again in American history. Virtually every populist movement in the South has been split along racial lines, and lots of progressive movements in the North have been split that way, too.
Although the FBI was both lauded and criticized for its efforts in the Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney case, Carolyn Goodman feels that more should have been done by the government to prevent similar tragedies. Here, she recalls a meeting with President Johnson following her son's untimely death.
There were changes in the South resulting from the actions of young activists like Andy. During the early stages of the civil rights movements, there was no federal support, no protection to the activists in many of the southern Mississippi towns, such as Meridian, Longdale, Canton. And after the murder of Andy, James, and Michael, Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Act. And at a meeting with President Johnson, with myself and my husband, along with our lawyer, who suggested that in Jackson there should be a federal presence. President Johnson, who is quite a manager and mover, doubted that he could send the man who was head of the FBI at that time, a well-known racist, Hoover. However, Johnson sent him to Jackson, and the office was opened. The civil rights activists finally had a presence.
In the end, something positive may have come from the deaths of Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Michael Schwerner in the form of increased civil rights legislation. But much more significant are the marks this incident left on the conscience of a nation. If there is hope of us ever learning to judge not by the color of skin, but by the content of character, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, it will be because we remember the effects that the opposite has had on our history. Until then, people will continue to tell the stories of the three young men murdered in Mississippi in 1964.
As I look back now, I see somebody who had been touched by the hand of God. That was very, very clear.
Titus Bender teaches at Eastern Mennonite College and worked alongside Michael Schwerner in the summer of 1964.
From the first day I met him, his courage, he was more pacifist than I in his heart. Not everybody that came south was necessarily for that freedom summer. But Mickey was the cream of the crop in terms of deep faith. I didn't know Rita as well, but got to know her somewhat and realized the terrible pressure she was under. Mickey was under the same pressures, but he just he seemed to be totally fearless and totally... I never sensed any animosity in him. Surely he had some. I never could see it. And I felt like in the deepest sense of the word, here was a person who was tuned into the universe in a way that, in a practical way that I hadn't reached. And I knew that Mickey was the target of some anger, To be honest about it, I've tried to figure that out because there were people that, you know, if you're going to bring 600-700 students, you're going to have every kind of person. You're going to have, on the one end of the spectrum would have been the gentleness of Mickey Schwerner. Now, by that, I don't mean he was a doormat. He was very active, but he was of demeanor just so gentle and listening. And then on the other end, you had people who had much quicker answers and a little more dogmatic, and they killed the gentlest one of the bunch, the gentlest one I knew. And I think maybe that's part of the reason, is because he was clearly had faith that outshone our own, I guess. It's the only way I can figure it out. Maybe it was just pure coincidence, it just happened to be him. But anyhow, that's the way I see it, because it was something about his life was difficult to deny.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. Bruderhof Radio is produced by Andrew Zimmerman.